thank you so much for being prepared to be interviewed. It's really nice to have such a range of women's voices. So Leila, my first question is usually, like, can you say a little bit about yourself, your background, whether your parents were supportive, that sort of thing?
Right. Okay. Well, I was, I suppose I was sort of in my mid, I was in my mid 30s when I was at Greenham. But before that, I had married quite young at 22. I had married a person of color from Mauritius. I had to settle my family on that because I came from a small rural Essex, very conservative town on the East Coast, where everyone voted conservative. And it was very unusual to find anyone who had socialist ideology or ideas or anything. But I seem to have been born with them for some reason, much to the horror of my father, particularly, who was what in those days might have been regarded as a cap-doffing Tory. He was a working-class man, very low paid. Mum had to go out to work to pay rent. He always worked, but with very little. So I grew up in a household post-war, 50s, where it was a struggle. But by the time I'd reached, I think, about 11, I had great reading skills, and I would read copious amounts of books that I would get from the library by running on the floor into the adult section and getting adult books to read. And many of those books were just random collections. And one I picked was about a downtown hospital in America. And of course, America was a place I know nothing about. And when I read that book, I realized that there would be all the poverty-stricken people, and the doctors who were training would go there and use them as part of their training. That's the only form of medicine they got. And that really horrified me that people would be treated like that. And then we had the UDI in Africa, where the British government was supporting this white leader taking over the country and declaring unilateral independence. And then I became aware of things like apartheid. And then I became aware of things. And then things moved on. I joined and trained as an SRN. I left school at 15 and worked, and then decided that that wasn't really what I wanted to do. I wanted to, I had this really grand idea that I wanted to be a professional. And I'd seen all these adverts for Alexander's Queen nurses, and they looked so grand. But I didn't get to be recruited for them, but I went and joined the nursing school at a hospital in Colchester where I studied. And that's where I met my husband, who was doing his training as well. And he was a socialist from Mauritius, and he had met some wonderful people there. What was his name then, Saeed?
Patrick Gordon Walker.
Patrick Gordon Walker.
And Fenner Brockway.
They were all people that he had known about, and they were all peacemakers and, CND people against
Noel Baker.
And Noel Baker. There were many, many people that he knew. So we had a lot in common as a couple, and socialism was one of them. So we joined Labour Party and all that business. And of course, that was at the time we're now up to about 1968, and that we joined social justice movements, lots of them. Anti-racism was one thing, because we couldn't find anywhere to live when we got married. People kept shutting the door in our face. If I went, it was okay. But the minute they saw us as a couple, suddenly the place had gone. So we had experienced racism. And at that time, then we moved. He got another job in another hospital. So we moved. And that's where we became part of where I'm still living, in the same village that we moved to. But we joined the Labour Party and became very active. I think my first campaign was about the abuse of tea pickers in what was then called Ceylon, but now Sri Lanka. So I had been active in the Women's Labour section, which was a fantastic place to be educated as a young woman into politics and feminism and things like that. And I think from there we were in CND, Anti-Nazi League, Rock Again. I mean, a whole load of things we were engaged with. And my children used to come along with us because I had two children by the time I was 30, and they were very much involved in the politics at the time. I mean, my son's got a T-shirt signed by Anthony Wedgwood Benn when we were on the March for Jobs. We were very involved in that locally. So it was quite, it wasn't a big deal to join the, my activism towards the anti-nuclear thing then crescendoed into the Watford Women's Peace Group, which was a group that we joined. And from there, we made our first visit to Greenham. I think that was on the 12th of December. We went with our kids to join Ringing the Base. And that was a fantastic experience. I took my daughter. She was about 7 years old at the time. And we did lots of, we left photographs on the fence, and we wove lots of webs all over the place in the suffragette colours. And that's really when we started our support group for Greenham, for the Greenham Common. And we did a lot of work with that. So that's really about it, how it came. And I've always remained, I'm 76 now, and I'm still a raging activist.
Fantastic. Oh, that's such a life path that you've just described. So your first sort of time of going to Greenham was for the Embrace the Base, which is the anniversary is this year.
Yes, that's right. Yes, fantastic. It was a mind-blowing experience, really, for me and the other women. First of all, we encountered men who said they wanted to join us. And then there was a dispute between some of the women who'd come, because we had said no, the movement wanted to remain female. It didn't want to have the inclusion of men, not because we were anti-men, but because it felt that it was about life, and women are about life in that sense, giving life, giving birth, and that they didn't want men because they felt they would take over the movement and take it into a different place. And we wanted it to be non-violent. We didn't want aggression within the campaigning or within the actions. So that was really the first discussion. The first time I kind of stood up and said, no, this needs to be women only and children if it's safe to do so. We did. That was the first thing. And then from there, Well, I think we were made aware of the March from Wales through the CND, local CND, and that's what galvanised the coach being put together to go to the action. And we knew that the government had, by stealth, not totally agreed to have the cruise missiles sighted there, but they were busy building the silos, which led to the idea that, well, if they're doing that, then there's something else going on as well. And although they didn't sanction it till 1983, I think, the idea was already planted. So by the end of 82, we moved into 83, where things really started to hot up and the actions started to be more focused. I think the stock exchange was the first time women laying in the road, which was, you know, hadn't been seen since the time of the suffragettes, I don't think. And they got the same kind of treatment as the suffragettes: abuse, violence, aggression from the authorities. I wasn't at that action, but I knew all about it. And it again shocked me, you know, that we can't protest with dignity without being abused, really. So that was it.
So you had a local sort of support, a local Greenham support group.
Yes, we did.
Did you adopt a particular gate when you were going to Greenham in the end?
No, we would go where the call came. We weren't sort of blue gate or yellow gate or red gate or any of that. No, we went when the call came. If they needed support, we would go there. And what our group did was it met on a regular basis. We raised money. We collected wood and logs. We collected foodstuffs. We collected clothing. We collected sleeping bags. We collected all of those things that were needed, that were asked for. Anything that was asked for, money, we worked to provide it. And we also would, as I said, go to any of the actions. And we trained ourselves legally so that we were aware of our rights if any of us were arrested, and one of us was. But, I mean, it was important that both ends met, if you see what I mean. Many of us were working full time, like many women. And so for some of us, I mean, we were a diverse group. We were working class women. We were women who were, we had Quakers. We had church women. We had a real range of women. They weren't all in the Labour Party and so on and so forth, but they were a diverse group. And I really learned something there, that one of my friends who had been highly educated and was from a musician family and all the rest of it, the first time I realized as a working class woman that actually middle class people can be poor as well, that just because you had the benefit of all that, it didn't mean to say that you were living a really luxurious life at all, that the struggle was the same. If you had children, it seemed to me, you know, maybe there were slight differentials at that time, but we kind of identified with each other very readily. And we did lots of trusting exercises and lots of consciousness raising. That's when I was first introduced to consciousness raising, and the group solidified itself by that activity. And the age range was elderly women to very young women who were students. So it was a broad range of women in our group. There was about 20 of us, all told, that did this. I think, you know, one action I remember, if you want me to talk about one action that we went to, I think it was called by one of the gates because they were trying to stop the cruise missiles coming in on the lorries and all the rest of it. And we were there. And at some point in the event, we our group were surrounded by police horses. And I can't tell you, it was so scary because those police horses are very, very tall horses. They're not little ponies. They're very strong, resilient horses, and with police officers with batons sitting on top of them. And they surrounded us and tried to corral us. So we all joined hands and we all sang, "She's Like a Mountain." And we kept singing it over and over and over. And you could see that that was really having an impact on the police. And they then began gradually to widen the circle and let us go freely. But it was quite a frightening, but it's amazing the power of unified women's voices. And I think a lot of women in our group, and although we went our different ways eventually into different things, we learnt a great deal of how to be strong and raise our voices and accept that we had a right to do that, even though you know, people could get arrested. You know, we knew we had to learn what was the breach of the peace, not to damage property. But then, you know, a Newbury council was busy trying to reclaim the common, even though it was common land. I think eventually they lost the case, but, you know, they tried to move us off the common and put us on the side roads and do all sorts of things. I'm sure you know much of this anyway, and you've heard much of it and experience. I don't know I'm not sure of your background, so I don't know whether I'm preaching to the converted here, really.
you're not preaching to me. You're preaching to the oral archive. I mean, I was involved for about 16 years, and we did reclaim the common, because the missiles were actually only on the common for about 5 years. Yes, and it took over 16 years to actually reclaim the common. It's one of my questions often around, you know, did you have any feelings, about reclaiming the common? How were you able to carry on supporting that? The cruise missiles went, you know?
Yes, I think we were very clear that when you talk about common land, it should remain common land. And that the whole idea that somebody could just change the law because they didn't like the fact that people were protesting there, well, isn't that what common land is meant to be for? You know, people go to Hyde Park on a regular basis at Speaker's Corner. All over the country, there are iconic statues of people who've stood in various places asking or demanding their rights under our laws. And I think that if people actually want to go to court and take away things that are owned in common, that's a massive problem. And it worries me today that protesting is now being sidelined again and made illegal. How can that be commensurate with a country that has such a history of democracy? Mm. It's hypocritical, isn't it? Mm. And and then I remember encountering another demonstration that wasn't to do with Greenham as such, but it was to do with the Americans' first invasion of Iraq. And I had to come back from abroad, and I got a phone call when I got in the house from a friend of mine who said, tomorrow I'm going outside the American embassy. Can you join me? So the following day I jumped on a train with her, and we went to the American embassy in London, and we, with many other people, stood outside demonstrating. And within about half an hour, we were all kettled. And that was the first time that I had been to any demonstration where I had actually seen the police diligently kettle everyone, and anyone who didn't move was put into a Black Mariah. They were all lined up in the side streets around the embassy. And I think that happened to the students when they reacted against the student loans being implemented and hiked up after 2010. So the stampeding on our democracy, on our rights to speak, are, I think, under threat in many different quarters. And then, of course, you have, the current issues to do with sex versus gender and the no platforming of people there. So as a woman, I'm quite used to challenging the notion that I should not speak or that I should shut up and not express my views. And we are entitled to do that. As long as we're doing it in a way that isn't harming other people or breaking the law, you know. But, you know, what's obstruction these days? I mean, what were the women doing on the common in London when they were showing their respects to the woman who was murdered by the police officer? They were felled to the ground and put in cufflinks and marched off as if they were criminals. And they were on common land.
Yeah, I'm... It's sort of criminalizing the population. I think I would add that we did break the law. I mean, the law is made, you know, but we still have to break it.
Well, of course, we went into court many times down there at Greenham, the magistrates' court. I mean, one of our youngest people who was willing to jump over the fence, I think that was on New Year's Day, 1983, on the silos, and was dancing around with about 46 other women, or however many it was. I can't remember exact numbers now, but she was arrested. But we planned for all of that. You know, we had factored in that we might break the law and get arrested. But breaking the law to save humanity seemed like a good enough reason. And I think that was the speeches that were made in the courts at the time, either turning your back on the court because you didn't recognize it, or using that court arena to make the case. And I think the case was made time and time again, very, very beautifully and very articulated well. I mean, our biggest hate, if you like, came from the press. And I could never, what was her name? Lady Olga Maitland?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness me. The Daily Mail had a field, and the Express and all those papers had a field day with all of that, didn't they? Because Heseltine set her up as the pro-nuclear women. I mean, it was like the women that were set up to be anti our right to have the vote. It was the same kind of governmental tactics. Very, very interesting, I think. How we had to combat all that, because the public just saw us as, you know, women beyond the pale, women who'd stepped over the line, women who were not in their place, if you see what I mean. And what about the children? And what about who's cooking the dinner? You know, it was all this kind of like sexist misogyny mixed up together, wasn't it? And pictures of women being dragged through the mud by the police and the public not objecting. Although I think in the end, the public did realise that it was a just cause. Whether they believe that the removal of cruise missiles was their campaign or something that we were doing as a statement, not just to our country, but to the world after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the proliferation of the nuclear arms race that was going on at the time. And I was talking with my husband last night about it, about the fact that there's still American bases here in this country. And we've got fast lanes, so we've still got the presence, and there's still the public who approve of Trident, irrespective of the ridiculous cost and waste of money. And you think, well, who is the enemy? Everything at the moment has been played out in the Middle East, Iraq, Afghanistan, and now on the borders of the Ukraine. So it never ends, does it, Ray?
No. I mean, one of my questions was like, how did your involvement with Greenham impact your life? But you've just told us. You're still really busy campaigning.
Yes, I mean, I still don't believe that. And I think we said at the time, didn't we, that the problem is that our government is telling the population that crews and the other bases for this are for our defence. But actually, what they're not telling you is they're making us a target. That we are the target. And what was it said? I think 200 mile radius around the Greenham Common would be the fallout if that did become a realistic target, because it was still the Cold War going on. There was still little, there were lots of movements towards the stopping of the proliferation. But that was only in America, Britain, Europe's interest to stop other people getting the bomb that they didn't want. Quite happy for some people to have it, but not others. Again, you know, this duplicity and very powerful sort of messages. And people get frightened. You know, they did believe, Tony Blair, that we were in 45 minutes of being attacked by Iraq.
Yeah.
How was that ever possible? I mean, my kids and I, we all went on that demo when that was all about to kick off again. And but they didn't listen. 2 million people marched and they didn't listen. They were determined to do that. And look at the mess. The Afghanistan has just gone back to the Middle Ages. There's nothing was gained for women at all. And that's the tragedy for me. In the Yemen and places like that, and across the globe, women are still without rights, without political clout, without the opportunity to defend their rights and their children, to have a decent life. Basics are not there. Water, sanitation, good food, education for girls and boys. So many women are without the UN's CEDAW declaration of all of these things now seem to have been captured by administrative purposes and, you know, what I call grandstanding. So I don't have any faith in that. I prefer to work at grassroots and change things, because out of our group, to just roll back a bit, I think we, you know, for some reason we stopped going to Greenham. I think once it was said that cruise missiles were no longer there or they'd been removed. We went on and the group continued its consciousness raising, and we set up a rape crisis and incest support line. And that's still going today in our locality. So there were lots of positive things that came out of women uniting. And I think that's one of the key messages, that when women do unite, not just for themselves and their needs, but society in general benefits. And I think that's not understood by government, that if you treat women well, if women get a fair deal and a fair crack at everything, not equality, because I don't believe in it. I'm a Germaine Greer supporter. She thinks, and I believe too, I've written articles about it, that I don't think it's equality to join the army and go and kill people as a woman. I can't see how. And then those women get a hell of a bad time. I've read all the reports from women out there in Afghanistan and Iraq about what happened to them by the men, not by the enemy, but by the men in their own platoons, in their own groups, sexually assaulting, raping. That's not equality. I don't know if you tuned into the one about processions, which was the book written, or the essay written by Virginia Woolf called Processions, where she, in the late 20s, early 30s, yeah, she wrote about male professions. And she felt that if women did enter those male professions, that would give women more power. But actually, the patriarchal analysis of that is they don't want us.
What you've been describing is what I think of as Greenham women everywhere. You know, you didn't have to be living at Greenham to be a Greenham woman. And no. And exactly, we all took that home, a lot of us, it changed us forever in how we, yes, involved ourselves in politics. Yes. And so that's sort of part of the Greenham legacy. Have you got anything else to say about what you feel is the Greenham legacy?
Well, the legacy is with my daughter and my granddaughters. I've been very blessed with three granddaughters and one grandson. And I've been able to use those experiences to talk to them. They have written about them in their schoolwork about Greenham. They've written about women's activism, women's rights. They're very, my daughter's very conscious raised. The eldest one is 29 this year, very, very aware of herself as an independent woman with rights. And I think that, to me, is the legacy for me. I can't change the entire world, but I can influence where I am. I'm still an activist and supportive of women's groups. In fact, I'm off to Scotland tomorrow for a radical feminist gathering. What I take from that is there'll be young women there, and they've asked me to do a little workshop on Greenham, because so many of them don't know what that is. Heard the name, don't know what went on, don't know about that. So as well as us knitting, I'm going to teach some of them to knit. Hopefully knit some little what I call resistance caps in suffragette colours, simple pattern that I made up, and then just pass that history on and about the other activism that I was involved with. And I think as older women, we have a duty to do that where we can. I also give talks to local women's groups on Greenham and the suffragette movement. I always do it with a quiz, and I'm astounded how little women know about their own history. But I knew that from school when I was 14. Why did I need to know about the Jethro Tull seed machine? I couldn't understand it.
I mean, what? I'm just going to pop in here over the knitting, because I think you ought to show them how to weave a web as well.
Yes, I'd probably do that with just some sticks.
Web weaving was a really useful tool as a non-violent form of blockading.
It was. The women who laid on the floor and wound the wool around themselves and everybody else, it was fantastic. And it was very hard to untangle us from those situations. And it was also about bonding, wasn't it? And I think authorities were terrified that if this caught on, what would happen to their Sunday roast? What would happen to their kids being looked after? It put the whole, I think, of the establishment into flux. And their only response was to call us nasty names and put Olga Maitland onto us, And I thought, oh, poor that is, isn't it? That's a bit poor.
Sounds a bit familiar. Sounds familiar, doesn't it, with the current tactics?
Yes, and the police don't change. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. They're still happy to rough up women, aren't they, whether they're in the cells. I mean, I worked for the last job I did. I worked for an organisation called Women in Secure Hospitals, and I was the sort of South East and Midlands director of that service, and we would provide advocacy to Broadmoor, Ashworth and Rampton hospitals and all the other secure places where women were, and also Holloway Prison and various other women's prisons where women were being diverted from the general prison estate of women to this forensic psychiatric services. And most of the complaints were about the male officers that were working in women's estate, and I doubt that's changed. There were huge issues with drug use in terms of giving women sleeping tablets and drugs to put them to sleep so they wouldn't be unhappy at night. And quite often that meant they were half in a state of coma during the night, and they would often get sexually abused by the prison officers on nights. I did that for about 7 years, and I learned a huge amount from that work. It was very specific work, and we were working very closely with a few people in the profession who wanted to get women out of these high secure hospitals. And I think with the exception of a few women at Rampton, there are now dedicated services to women in this category that is based upon what we call a relational model of service with therapies rather than a secure security where you handcuff women and bulldoze them, cosh them with drugs to quiet them down. The reason women are loud is because they need to say things that they've not been allowed to say. And then I retired.
Well, up to a point you retire. Doesn't sound like you're exactly living life in the slow lane.
No, but I live in a slow lane village, which is very helpful, actually. It's very grounding. I've got a big garden, so we're both very avid gardeners, and we love our garden, and we work very closely together in our garden and other activities. Yeah.
Nice.
It's nice to grow old with the same person you met when you were 20.
yeah, well done. I just curious as to how you found out about these interviews that we're doing, and how do you hear about Green and Women Everywhere?
I over the years I've kind of kept in touch with anything that went online and up to date. But when I went to Felia this last year,
all right,
there was a workshop, And I had just had to attend that and sing and meet some of the Welsh women and just connect with the young women who are dealing with this pay. And one of the other women there, she was the host for the Philia conference. Did you go to Philia?
Not this year, no.
No, you didn't go. It hadn't been on for a couple of years, had it? So my niece came over from Paris. She loves Philia. So we went we went down to Portsmouth together and we went to Philia. And I attended that workshop and they were talking about the project. And I was so delighted that she was the daughter of one of the women. I mean, my daughter lives in Mauritius and she's not here. And she's lived there for 11 years now. So with my two youngest grandchildren, two girls. But she wouldn't have been able to be involved in that. But I think she would have liked to have been. And they were talking about the interviews. And I think I took a leaflet or something. And I emailed Green and Women Everywhere. And they got back to me. And I think we were going to set up interviews and things like that. So that's how I got involved. And I thought, I'd like to tell my story because I think all of us have something to say. All of us have moved on from there, done different things, but we still carry it with us. I taught all of them to sing She's Like a Mountain. They all know that. I used to swing them and sing it in the garden swing.
Yeah, lovely. Old and strong.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we're now old and strong.
Yes. Well, it happens, doesn't it?
But I think you're very right. I feel that way about being older and not having to go to work anymore. It is that we've got a responsibility to the younger generations and
absolutely.
And to do that outreach and actually to take control of our herstory, because otherwise who's gonna whatever versions they might see are probably gonna be quite hateful. If you look at the media at the time, it was really, really hateful to us.
It was very, very misogynist and very, very directed towards labelling us all with what they thought were slurs and involving lesbian women in those slurs, which I thought was horrendous. It had nothing to do with what sexuality us as women were. We were a broad consensus of women, huge numbers of women. We weren't boxed into anything. And many women came from Europe to join the camp. Many women came from all over the place. It was a centre for women to come and show solidarity and protest against the nuclear arms race and the kind of things that are going on in Europe after a terrible war. Here we were again, building it up, somewhere, I think I'm going to make inquiries, but one of the women that was with us, a woman called Jill, I think she has the banner that we made for Greenham. And on the banner are patchworks. We were all asked to do a patchwork of something, of a symbol, and then it was put on the banner. And myself and my daughter, we did something. So there is somewhere it is. I think we met about a few years back, about four or five of us, but we haven't met since. So I'm going to put a few feelers out to see, maybe in a couple of weeks' time, to see if I can round up where the banner is, if I can ask for it. I've kept my own archives. I've got loads. And I wouldn't, I'd rather see it burnt than go.
I do think that the whole Greenham reclaiming, Greenham women and putting this on the map again, historically, is a really good way of reasserting that.
Yes.
And one of the comments that sometimes come up is, I was on the reunion on the Common this summer when I did some of the walk and then back on the Common, and that a lot of the questions, there's a sort of subtext to, well, it couldn't happen now, or do you think it could happen now to have this? I just think if women want it to happen, it'll happen.
Yes.
Got anything to say?
But I think we say that would it happen? But then that was a different time. We didn't have a pandemic going on. We didn't have access. You know, we had a phone wheel. That's how we kept in touch with each other. You know, we had this phone wheel with our names on it, and we would pass, one would phone the other, and that, so the information would go around that way. And leaflets and, you know, newsletters that we would do and hand out at the meeting, or just meet every week on a regular basis. But I think that we're doing it, but in different ways.
Yeah.
I think that it's harder to reach women, because I think the burden on women for the two people having to go out to work today is more intense than I think it ever was. I think people worry a lot about their children and about poverty, because, you know, I think in the last, since 2010, poverty has increased. There's more women have greater worries than things outside of themselves. And I think that that is quite a difficult thing. Women have become depoliticized because they don't see that they're being wronged necessarily because they're women, because they've been told that they're equal.
You've carried on growing from your Greenham experiences, and that's really nice to see.
Yes, very much so. And it's, I tell everyone that I was there. You know, anyone I meet, not repeating to the same person, but when I meet people, I will always talk about Greenham, because I think it was, of its time, it was extremely unique historical moments.
Yeah,
very much so, since the suffragettes. And I mean, it just goes to show the power that women, and I think that's why it's not part of the school curriculum, because if you was to show footage of what went on there, young women would be able to see how their power can be used once they were united, rather than being seen as adversaries of each other like they are today, comparing each other and so on and so forth. We didn't have much time for that, because you couldn't dress up down at Greenham. you had to be very practical down there with your boots and your warm clothing and all that, because somehow all the action seemed to take place in the cold weather. I remember it all with great affection, and the women that I spent that time with great affection. And it gives me a great deal of pleasure to be able to revisit all that. And
you're still carrying Greenham home.
Absolutely. Right to the grave. I might have that put on my gravestone. I'll ask, if I go before him, I'll ask him to put that on my gravestone. I'm carrying Greenham home.
All the way to the line.
Wherever it leads.